Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the Fireside Room, the speaker is Gary Simpson, and he will be speaking on Identity and Imagination, the 8th, 9th, and 10th Commandments. So let's listen in on Gary.
This is from Luther on the 7th Commandment in the Large Catechism, which is a great thing to read, and most Lutherans never read it. We'll commend this to you. I've always had a dream, or a fantasy, or a nightmare, something like that, that as a pastor, I would just get up on some Sunday morning, and preach on the seventh commandment, and do it by reading what Luther has to say here in the Large Catechism, and not tell anybody it was Luther, and see if I got thrown out of the congregation. Because he has some very interesting, I cut out some parts just to shorten it up about, but he has some very interesting things to say when it comes to the seventh commandment. So we'll have to see if they speak to us today. So what I propose that we do is people volunteer to read, and that we open up some, you can't read ahead of time, you're reading ahead.
I'm just getting ready to be the first one.
You're scanning, okay. Why don't you, since you're already chuckling a little bit, why don't you read the first paragraph there? And some of this stuff, as I say, we might agree with, some of us we wouldn't, maybe. And some of us, and actually when it comes to the seventh commandment, one of the things that Luther did with the commandments is he tried to give kind of his interpretation in the late 1520s of kind of life, the totality of life, as much of the totality of life. So he took the commandments as opportunities to try to talk about everything in life. And you'll see the kinds of things he takes up here are what today we would call the economy. And so it's really kind of, I suppose, what people would call today economic ethics or economic philosophy or something like that. Now, in Luke, that's one of the things that is quite distinctly different today than in the 16th century. And if we had some more time, we can trace some of the moves that have happened since the 16th century till now. But let's just read them and see what we got. Go, take a shot on that first paragraph, if you'd like.
Okay. You shall not steal. Next to our own person and our spouse, our temporal property is dearest to us.
Just a little tricky footnote on that. He's been going through the commandments. So next to our own person, that would have to do with the fifth commandment, thou shalt not kill, talking about my own person. The sixth commandment has to do with thou shalt not commit adultery, so our spouse. So he's kind of next to the fifth commandment and the sixth commandment, our temporal property, the seventh commandment, is dearest to us.
This too God wants to have protected. He has forbidden us to rob or pilfer the possessions of our neighbor. For to steal is nothing else than to acquire another's property by unjust means. In a few words, this includes taking advantage of our neighbor in any sort of dealing that results in loss to him. Stealing is a widespread common vice, but people pay so little attention to it that the matter is entirely out of hand. If all who are thieves, though they are willing to admit it, were hanged on the gallows, the world would soon be empty and there would be a shortage of both hangmen and gallows. That's what I was laughing.
That's right. The IRS would like this line.
They know it already. Yeah. As I have just said, a person steals not only when he robs a man's strong box or his pocket, but also when he takes advantage of his neighbor at the market, in the grocery shop, butcher stall, wine and beer cellar, workshop, and in short, wherever business is transacted and money is exchanged for goods or labor. So there.
So what do you find out of it? What are some of the things that he's kind of getting at here? What kinds of things are, this is his introductory paragraph. He's pretty much endearing all of his listeners to him.
They're all guilty,
that's one thing, I suppose, or almost, huh? What kinds of things does he include under stealing? What?
Anything that's taking advantage of somebody.
Yes, one of them is taking advantage.
Well, this
just a moment. That was actually the second one that he held. Taking advantage. First thing that he had mentioned was kind of just
acquired, kind of not just
common robbery, huh?
Yeah.
But I suppose, you know, one of the things that Luther always wants to do is take these commandments and kind of, as Jesus says in some place in the Gospels, in Matthew, I think the book of Matthew, where Jesus talks about the speck in your brother's eye. You know, don't go around looking for the speck in your brother or sister's eye when you've got a log in your own eye. And Luther seems in the commandments to be following that advice. In other words, hey, let's not just point at, you know, those bad robbers there that, you know, end up going to jail, actually break into your house. That, of course, does have to do with stealing. But he wants to bring it a little bit closer home, huh? Taking advantage of somebody. What else in that?
She doesn't use the word, but I see cheating in here.
Cheating! What kinds of things might be included in cheating?
Well, you take advantage of somebody in paperwork, a business transaction.
Yeah.
Income tax.
In those days, they didn't have income taxes, but they did have some kinds of taxes, of course.
I think the whole concept of let the buyer beware. That would be.
Let the buyer beware. Well, that will be interesting. Let's see if Luther says anything. Of course, I could have always chopped those sections out or something. But so, that's kind of a contemporary. In what circumstance would you say let the buyer beware?
Well, that's sort of like taking advantage, where you're selling somebody something and you know that there's something wrong with it, but you don't tell them.
Yes.
You know, that kind of thing.
So you let the buyer beware, be suspicious of the other people, of the sellers.
In our area where there are very few building codes, buyers of houses have to be very careful when they buy.
You think about, what was the last big hurricane down there in Florida? Andrew. When all those houses got flattened and there were building codes that they say the buildings would have stood. Many of the houses would have stood if the building codes had been lived up to, and what did they find out? The inspectors had been bought off when they went back and found that. So the codes were in place even to save all these homes and in a few lives. But I suppose that would be maybe the cheating or the taking advantage of these. It'll be interesting to see if Luther has any, would have a correlate to that. We'll see. Anything else anybody can think of? Well, it is widespread, common. People pay little attention to it, that kind of thing. Thieves that were unwilling to admit. Let's do the next paragraph. You want to try the next one, anybody?
Furthermore, at the market and in everyday business, the same fraud prevails in full force. One person openly cheats another with defective merchandise, false measures, dishonest weights, and bad coins, and takes advantage of him by underhanded tricks and sharp practices and crafty dealing. Or again, one swindles another in a trade and deliberately fleeces, skins, and torments him. Who can even describe or imagine it all? In short, thievery is the most common craft and the largest guild on earth.
Kind of institutionalized, huh?
The mafia alive, eh? If we look at mankind in all its conditions, it is nothing but a vast, wide, stable, full of great thieves.
He is really how to win friends and influence people. He's about as pointed in the seventh commandment as any place in the catechisms. I think I think this he saved all of his pen for this one. He really goes after them. Well, you think about that today, you know, you think about that second line, huh? Openly, defective merchandise. Lemons. False measures. That's exactly this living up to the building codes, huh? What's agreed upon in the community is defrauded. Dishonest weights. There was a scandal not too long ago in the Twin Cities because they were charging more. The price of gasoline on the, you know, it says one thing, but they were actually getting more. And apparently even the federal inspectors were in the take on it.
Well, I think they used to talk about that really expensive foam that some measures had, you know, because they always waved their foam along with everything.
Oh, yes. Bad coins. They probably had a little bit more trouble with bad coins, although I just was reading just last week that they're going to be doing new dollar bills in the United States, mm-hmm. and one of the reasons is counterfeit. Takes advantage by underhanded tricks, sharp practices, and crafty dealing. I'm not sure if that's advertising and marketing or not in our day and age, but it could be, couldn't it?
The whole tobacco industry.
Yeah, so that's an interesting conversation going on today, huh? Hot and heavy in the halls of Congress, even, finally. Well, let's keep going on a little bit. He had skipped a couple of paragraphs, by the way. And in those paragraphs that I had skipped, you notice on the right-hand border, there's some numbers, and those are kind of numbered paragraphs. And you notice that 225, 226 are skipped. And in 225, he was talking to and about servants, so probably employees. Particular household employees and being unfaithful in domestic duties and damage and things done like that. And in 26, he's talking about artisans, workmen, and day laborers. And so I kind of skipped those in order to get to furthermore the marketplace and everyday business. So I had skipped over a couple, but he has some good things to say about those other folks as well. Let's do 229, that next paragraph there.
These men are called gentlemen swindlers or big operators. Far from being pickpockets and sneak thieves who loot a cash box, they sit at pompous chairs and are called great lords and honorable good citizens. And yet, with a great show of legality, they rob and steal.
Well, you think of the savings and loan scandals or lots of other kinds of things. What's that? Insider trading? Yeah, insider trading. Big shots. Big deals, gentlemen, swindlers. So he's casting the net of the seventh commandment widely. How about 230?
Yes, we might well keep quiet here about various petty thieves in order to launch an attack against the great, powerful arch thieves who consort with lords and princes and daily plunder not only a city or two, but all Germany. Indeed, what would become of the head and chief protector of all thieves, the Holy See at Rome, and all its retinue, which has plundered and stolen the treasures of the whole world and holds them to this day?
Not exactly the nice thing to say about the Holy Father. So he goes in from the big dealers to the powerful. He's really putting it out there today. Well, there is, you know, this connection, there always has been, I suppose, this connection between politics and people of money and means, and in his day as well. Um, 231 kind of sums it up. This, in short, is the way of the world. Those who can steal and rob openly are safe and free, unmolested by anyone, even claiming honor from people. Meanwhile, the little sneak thieves who have committed one offense must bear disgrace and punishment so as to make the others look respectable and honorable. So, you know, one of the things he's complaining about is, you know, that basically poor people are in jail and good, honorable, respectable people get off easily, if not, you know, actually have the chair of honor in the boards of controls and things like that.
It hasn't changed.
Hasn't changed a bit. Now, there certainly are a lot of similarities, aren't there? It's amazing how in 500 years there are some dynamics that seem to be similar, if not exactly the same. And so then he kind of concludes this section by saying, this commandment is very far-reaching indeed, as we have shown. I suppose that most of the people who are reading this, the large catechism, aren't the powerful and the rich. Most of them, I mean, it was written primarily for common people, for commoners. That last line that I didn't read in 231, but the latter should be told that in the eyes of God they are the greatest thieves, and that God will punish them as they deserve. I'm wondering if Luther might say, you know, let the big shots beware. Or let the sellers beware. Or let the money beware. See. Somebody want to read 233? I'll finish that and we'll move over to the other side. Let everyone know then, that it is his duty, at the risk of God's displeasure, not to harm one's neighbor, take advantage of the neighbor, or defraud the neighbor by any faithless or underhanded business transaction. More than that, he is under obligation faithfully to protect one's neighbor's property and further the neighbor's interests, especially when the neighbor takes remuneration for such services. What Luther does in all of the commandments, for those of you who were with me earlier, he starts it way back already in the second commandment, but then he picks it up in the fifth commandment particularly. Some of you memorize the small catechism, thou shalt not steal, we should fear and love God that we may not take our neighbor's property or business. And then Luther has this, he takes these negatives, these negative obligations. Don't do this, you know, don't kill, don't commit adultery, don't steal. Negative duties, negative obligations. And then Luther always turns them, he's got this, but help and protect your neighbor's property and business. So not only do you not cross over of the boundary into your neighbor's property and take them away from them, either by pure robbery or by trying to take advantage and sneaking. But you also then, you move into your property, your neighbor's life, when that life is being threatened, and you help protect their property and business. So it's this outgoingness of Luther's understanding of the Christian, that a Christian is one who not only doesn't do things, but a Christian is one who also does do things for the sake of the neighbor. And so more than that, a Christian is under obligation faithfully to protect one's neighbor's property. So more than don't commit this, don't omit helping the neighbor. Well, let's move over to 240. He's going to take us... going to continue the same kind of rhetoric in lots of ways, but he's going to change the venue just a little bit. So we want to read that next full paragraph, top of the page.
The same fate will overtake those who turn the free public market into a carrion pit and a robber's den. Daily the poor are defrauded. New burdens and high prices are imposed. Everyone misuses the market in one's own willful, conceited, arrogant way, as if it were one's right and privilege to sell one's goods as dearly as one pleases without a word of criticism. We shall stand by and let such persons fleece, grab, and hoard. But we shall trust God, who takes matters into God's own hands. After they have scrimped and scraped for a long time, God will pronounce this kind of blessing over them. Your grain will spoil in the garner and your beer in the cellar. Your cattle will die in the stall. Yes, where you have cheated and defrauded anyone out of a golden, your entire hoard will be consumed by rust so that you will never enjoy it.
Yes, so now really what he's doing is kind of calling down God's judgment, huh? God's wrath. It'll be interesting to, you know, whether that happens. Or maybe one of the things he's saying, well, let's keep reading on, because he's going to actually bring up some of this. Any reflections on that? I don't know. Are we just willing to let stand by and let such persons fleece and grab and hold it?
I have a question with that.
Yeah.
Something comes to mind just as far as when you talk about the market, obviously, that kind of triggers in my own mind, like the stock market.
Yeah.
The CDs and those sorts of investments. I mean, is that something you could refer to? Because I think in this day and age, a lot of people are doing that just for retirement security and things such as that.
Yeah, that's a very interesting. Well, first of all, you know that, of course, the first stock companies didn't come up until about 100 years later after Luther's time. Remember what the first stock company was, by the way? In kind of the modern sense of owning stocks? It was the Dutch East Indies Company. When these exploring to the, quote, new world companies set out originally, well, you remember Christopher Columbus, who funded his operation?
Ferdinand.
Yeah, Ferdinand, the king and the queen. And what happened is the kings and the queens, the royalty funded these early excursions for a while. But what ended up happening in Europe is they began to have a number of, a whole series of kinds of wars, including the largest war, the worst war in Western history, in the history of Western society. Even worse than, in some ways, the two world wars was the 30 Years' War, which came up between the years 1618 and 1648. And when you start having wars, then where does your money go? Where does the royalty's money go? It gets diverted from space, sending people up to the moon, to sending people over to Vietnam, for instance. Yeah. So that's exactly what happened in the 17th century. And so when people were trying to get these excursions up the Dutch East Indies, instead of, they couldn't get money from royalty any longer, then they went to this new group of people that was just beginning to kind of rise up in Europe. And this new group of people was called, we call them today with a very original name, the middle class. They no longer went to the upper classes, but they went to the middle class, this rising group of property owners. That just, most people, peasants, which was most of European society up until this time, and in Luther's time, 99% of the people plus were peasants. And what peasants means is you basically lived hand to mouth, day to day. This new group of people were people who were moving into the crafts, into the guilds, and into some of the early professions like lawyers, and some medicine, and some kinds of businesses, and early trading, and those people got just enough money to put some aside every month, so to speak, and they were called property owners early on, or bourgeois, people who were able to own property. And so the Dutch East Indies Company went to those people and said, if you give us $100, we'll give you a promise that we will give you a certain percentage, a certain amount of stock of what we bring back from our explorations. And so there weren't exactly stock companies in Luther's time, but there was this the beginning of what we would call early capitalism. Where money was becoming more, instead of going to the market and exchanging some chickens for some clothes, you actually, or some grain or something, you actually started trading more and more in money. And so money was becoming more and more of a means of exchange. And so there were early phases of capitalism during Luther's time. And one of the early things in capitalism is what? Well, one of the definitions of capitalism is you make money off of money. In other words, you invest money and you get interest off of it. You make money off of money. Instead of making money off of your labor, you make it off, or your labor, you make it off of other money. And in Luther's time, there were actually some groups of people who were making money off of money. They were bankers. And they were making, they would loan out money. And in order to loan out $100, they said, after a year, you have to pay us back $100 plus four more. And so the interest rate was around 4%. And that was called, in Luther's day, and for about 1,000 years in medieval Europe, that was called usury. It was usurious. It was an unjust amount to take. The most you could take was 2% interest rate through the Middle Ages. What was kind of interesting is a lot of Christians in this early kind of capitalism needed money. They needed to get loans. But it was forbidden during medieval Europe for Christians to loan another person money for interest. You could loan somebody, but you could only get back whatever you loaned out. If you loaned out $100, you could only get $100 back. Actually, if you were a Christian, you would loan out people money, and if they could pay you back, okay, and if they couldn't, it wasn't a good deal. You couldn't take people to court. And so Luther was very upset, as many people were in medieval Europe, that some people were asking 4% interest rates. And so he wrote a very long tract about usury. What's part of the unfortunate part of that is that the only people that were allowed to loan money for any interest rate in Europe, in Christian Europe, weren't Christians. They were Jews. And so the Jews got into banking businesses. And one of the reasons they got into banking businesses were, first, Christians couldn't get into banking, and so only Jews could. Secondly, Jews in many parts and many time periods in Christian Europe could not own any property. So they couldn't be farmers. So the only thing they could do, or one of the things they could do, was to loan money. The other thing that Jewish people at that time had was Jews were mostly cross national borders. So they were families, large families. These large Jewish families got into banking. And they also had relatives, cousins and brothers and sisters and other things in different countries. So it was multinational. And so actually the Jewish banking companies were the first, what today we would call, multinational corporations. And because they were multinational, there were no laws that applied to them. And Luther didn't like that either, so he wrote a really hard, harsh trap about, actually quite a long treatise, a book of about 80 pages against usury. And because it works outside of the laws, and it asks for too much interest rates.
Is that where most of his anti-Jewish stuff is?
No, it's not actually. The large family in Europe at that time were named the Fuggers, and they were outside of Hanover. I think Hanover.
Augsburg.
Augsburg was one of the great business centers of Europe, actually. Augsburg was a tremendous trading center. I think the Fuggers were in Augsburg, and also I think they were up north. But they were also in Amsterdam and some other places. They were multinational. And so he went after the Fuggers quite. But his anti-Jewish tracts came actually later. The one on against usury was in the 1520s, I think around this time period, by the way. 1526, 27. The anti-Jewish tracts actually take place in the late 30s. And there's a number of reasons, not excuses, but there are a number of factors that go into those. Early on, Luther had a number of very cordial and what we would today call Jewish-Christian dialogues, so to speak. Luther was of the opinion that since the gospel
had been suppressed for such a long time in Christian Europe, and works righteousness had been preached, that once the gospel became known as the free grace and promise of God, that and Jews actually would hear that gospel, that they would all become Christians. And that the reason that they hadn't become Christians is because, because Christianity wasn't proclaiming the gospel anyway. So for a long time, he had long and very cordial relationships with a number of very prominent rabbis in town. Well, those dudes don't convert that quickly, or that easily, and for those kinds of reasons necessarily, and there's long, tradition, heritages involved. And some Jews started going after the doctrine of Christology and the God, Jesus being God, and God, a God human. And that's one of the factors. So in the late 30s, Luther wrote two very bad tracts against the Jews. There was also a lot of people think that he was very ill during those days and had some terrible illnesses. And sometimes they were so bad that he couldn't work at all, and he was very crotchety, more crotchety than here. More crotchety than usual. So they think the combination of his being disappointed over the Jews not converting and his crotchetiness, when he wrote Against the Jews and Their Lies, was the title of one of them. He recommended that the Jews be run out of Germany, not killed, interestingly enough, but run out of Germany, their property confiscated and burned and things like that. Pretty bad stuff.
In terms of what you just said about the interest in investments, where does the parable of the talents fit in? Isn't that an investment? And paying back double and
yes,
yeah, and that goes all the way back to Jesus time.
Well, what do y'all think about that? He actually will say some things, a little bit. By and large, Luther was very suspicious of early capitalism, trading with money. He thought that it was a system that was tremendously open to abuse. And he wasn't alone in that. Interestingly enough, Luther's kind of right-hand man, so to speak, the other prominent theologian in Germany, or one of the other great prominent theologians in Germany who wrote the Augsburg Confession, actually, Philip Melanchthon, one of the most learned people of all of medieval and Reformation Renaissance times was Philip Melanchthon. Melanchthon was much more progressive when it came to capitalism, much more open to seeing that Europe is changing and allowing for the possibility that God could work through capitalism. Luther was, when it comes to economics, very medieval. In other things, he was a little bit more reaching into the future. But he was quite medieval when it came, and rested more secure and trusted more in an agricultural society, interestingly enough. Melanchthon was a little bit open more to cosmopolitan ways of life, cosmopolitan societies. So I'm not sure whether the talents be interesting to read Luther and the talents, although he does think that people are going to get blessed, but not necessarily according with either monetary wealth. That he doesn't necessarily. In fact, he thinks if you follow Christ, well, you'll end up like him. Let's see what he has to say now. He comes. He's picked up now. This people about daily the poor are being defrauded up there in 240, and then he goes after kind of the rich people here who get or the people who get things by stealth. 243 now. Indeed, we have the evidence before. He's now, what is the evidence that God will kind of wreak vengeance or wreak havoc on people who fleece the poor? Indeed, we have the evidence before our very eyes every day that no stolen or ill-begotten possession thrives. How many people scrape and scratch day and night and yet grow not a penny richer? Though they gather a great hoard, they must suffer so many troubles and misfortunes that they can never enjoy it or pass it on to their children. There are some also parables he's he's alluding to. Remember the parable of, which parables can you think of? Remember the rich man who puts all the stuff in his barns and builds bigger barns, and then the next day, what happens? Dies, huh? And what happens to him when he dies? But then there's another story. Well, there's one of the other stories. Lazarus, the story about Lazarus and the rich man. A very interesting story in the Gospel of Luke, huh? Where what's interesting about that story is right off the bat, what we call it, the story of Lazarus and the rich man. What's interesting about that, the title of that story?
Lazarus comes first.
Yes, he comes first, and what else?
His name.
Yeah, Lazarus has a name. Who doesn't have a name? The rich man. Interesting. Just the reversal. This is in the Gospel of Luke, and you remember the Gospel of Luke starts off with the Magnificat, right? Where the God will reach down and raise up those of low degree, and those of high degree will level down. And so you got the story about the rich man and Lazarus. Sometimes it's rich, but the significant part is the poor guy has a name and identity, because everything is there. The rich man just has a description. So I think he does have these kinds. How many, though they gather a great hoard, they must suffer so many troubles and misfortunes that they can never enjoy it or pass it on to their children. But because we ignore this and act as if it were none of our business, God must punish us and teach us morals in a different way. It's kind of interesting. Now, how does God do this? Well, God lays on us one affliction after another, or God quarters a troop of soldiers upon us. You have to realize that. Also, what's going on at this time is there's a tremendous army sitting outside the gates of Vienna. Actually, it's the Turks, the Turkish army, the Islamic people, the Muslims, are sitting with a huge army right outside the gates of Vienna. And in charge of this army is a guy named Suleiman the Magnificent. And he was one of the most brilliant military minds of medieval Europe. And there were great books written about his strategies and things. And he was sitting at the gates of Vienna, Austria. Huh? You have to, I can't draw in Europe, but Vienna is over here in Austria is in Eastern Europe. And Vienna is also the head of the Habsburg family, this great dynasty that has been ruling Europe for a couple of hundred years and is presently ruling. The emperor is a Habsburg, and his name is Charles V. And Charles V has all kinds of problems because, first of all, because he's a Habsburg. And Francis I of France is not a Habsburg, and he has eyes on becoming the emperor. And so there's fights between Charles V, who was ruling the Holy Roman Emperor, and Francis I over here in the west. And on the east is Suleiman the Magnificent with his big army right outside the gates of Vienna. So if Vienna falls, all of Europe will fall. And Charles is, in fact, one of the reasons that there were these attempts at getting the Lutherans and the Catholics, the Roman Catholics and the Reformers together into a peace treaty, was if you have a united, you have to have a united, in those days you had to have a united kind of church in order to have a united Europe. And you had to have a united Europe in order to fight off the Turks, who had this great and well-trained army. And Luther was asked to write, should we go to war against the Turks? Because this question was always being raised. And Luther wrote a long treatise on war against the Turks. One of the first thing he said in there is, the first thing we must recognize is that there are two enemies at the gates of Vienna. There's Suleiman, and then there's God. And unless we repent of our injustice internally within Germany and the Holy Roman Empire, we'll never, in other words, unless we make peace with God and treat one another justly, we're never going to be able to be unified to fight off the other enemy. So Luther did think that the Islamic threat was a threat directly from God. that God was speaking to us. And so the seventh commandment, if you notice, starts off by talking about injustice. So this is the commandment about justice for Luther. It's the issue of justice. And he's beginning to get into this. So when he says God will quarter a troop of soldiers upon us, he's not just kind of that God's going to, you know, create this out of nothing, or that God's going to send a bunch of angels on horseback down there or all of a sudden, but that the very particular situation of Suleiman is there. In 1 hour they clean out our chests and push down to the last penny, and then by way of thanks they burn and ravage houses and homes and outrage and kill wife and children. Think about what's going on in many parts of the world today. In short, however much you steal, depend on it that just as much will be stolen from you. Now, I'm not sure whether, I don't really think that Luther thinks, I'm guessing, and I think from other things, that it's a one-to-one thing. You know, one rich person is that they're going to, you know, I think that he knows that some rich people, some thieves, some people who gain their wealth by thievery, probably will live out their days in peace and happiness, maybe. But he does think that a whole society that begins to turn on this way cannot survive, and it will fall, it will crumble, kind of internal corruption. And so you remember on this left side, he worries that that's happening in Europe, that things are getting so bad that you can't even go to the marketplace. However much you steal, depend on it that just as much will be stolen from you. Anyone who robs and takes things by violence and dishonesty must put up with another who plays the same game. So the whole game, the whole way of life comes down for everybody. For God is a master of this art. Since everyone robs and steals from the other, God punishes one thief by means of another. In other words, that's today we would call the consequences, huh? That God uses the natural consequences. Otherwise, where would we find enough gallows and ropes?
I guess he's for capital punishment, huh?
Yes. Which, of course, he wasn't alone. And in his day and age, you know, I can make arguments for capital punishment. For Luther, capital punishment is the only way you can stop violent people. Today, I think we have other possibilities. People who violate, I mean, you can throw away the key, or you can keep them in. I don't know if you were here earlier when we dealt with the fifth commandment. Luther is very aware of the vulnerability of the human creature, both physically and spiritually. And I used some examples yesterday. We were talking about how people kill the soul of one another. We also can have our bodies killed very easily too. And he's very interested in bodies. He's also interested in spirits, and he doesn't separate them out from one another. You know, you can look and stare and insult a chipmunk from now till doomsday, but it will not lower the chipmunk's self-esteem. But I can just raise my eyebrows to one of my daughters and it could destroy her on the spot. I can kill her self-esteem without even speaking a word. The human beings are tremendously vulnerable. Of all God's creatures, we may be next to the angels, but we are also the most vulnerable of all God's creatures. And at the heart of all of the commandments, from the fifth commandment on, actually, Luther is recognizing that, this issue of violence and vulnerability of humans. And so the commandments for Luther are boundaries. What we're having trouble with today in our society, particularly professional boundaries. And the disparity between rich and between powerful and powerless. Luther often uses the metaphor of, and he gets it from the Bible, he talks about wolves and sheep. There are those who are powerful, and without strong boundaries, they will eat up the sheep. And so he's doing the same thing here, only he has to do it particularly with property, as he'd done earlier with our bodies and our spirits in the fifth commandment, and in the sixth commandment with our the closest relationships, particularly a spouse. Whoever is willing to learn a lesson, let that one know that this is God's commandment and must not be treated as a joke. We shall put up with those of you who despise, fraud, steal, and rob us. I think you should, the us there is, I think he means us, people who are probably peasants or, I suppose, people of a certain means, enough to get by daily. We shall endure your arrogance and show forgiveness and mercy as the Lord's Prayer teaches. The upright, meanwhile, will not want, and you will hurt yourself more than others. But, this is kind of an interesting one now. No. In other words, if you fleece us, it's going to be bad enough for you. But, beware how you deal with the poor, on whom there are many now. If when you meet a poor person who must live from hand to mouth, you act as if everyone must live by your favor, you skin and scrape him right down to the bone, and you arrogantly turn the poor person away, whom you ought to give aid, that one will go away wretched and dejected. And because that one can complain to no one else, the poor person will cry to heaven. Beware of this. Here's the beware, by the way. Let the buyer beware. Beware if you fleece the poor. Beware of this, I repeat, as of the devil himself. Such a person sighs, as a poor person sighs and cries, will be no joking matter. They will have an effect too heavy for you and all the world to bear. For they will reach God, who watches over poor, sorrowful hearts, and God will not leave them unavenged. But if you despise and defy this, see whom you have brought upon yourself. If you succeed and prosper before all the world, you may call God and me liar. In other words, you know, do not be deceived. God is not mocked. A couple more paragraphs here. We have now given sufficient warning and exhortation. The one will not heed or believe this. May go one's own way until you learn it by experience. But it needs to be impressed upon the young people so that they may be on their guard and not follow the old wayward crowd, but may keep their eyes fixed upon God's commandment, lest God's wrath and punishment come upon them too. Our responsibility is only to instruct and reprove by means of God's word. To restrain open lawlessness is the responsibility of princes and magistrates. One of the things that has changed, of course, in our day, is that as citizens, we actually are the government. In his day, there were citizens too, but the distance, there was not anything close to a democratic or even a representative way of life. That is, princes and magistrates should be alert and resolute enough to establish and maintain order in all areas of trade and commerce, in order that the poor may not be burdened and oppressed, and in order that they may not themselves be charged with other people's sins. Enough has been said concerning the nature of stealing. It is not to be confined to narrow limits, but must extend to all our relations with our neighbors. To sum up, as we have done in the previous commandments, on the one hand, we are forbidden to do our neighbor any injury or harm in any way imaginable, whether by damaging, withholding, or interfering with one's possessions and property. We are not even to consent or to permit such a thing, but are rather to avert and prevent it. On the other hand, we are commanded to promote and further our neighbor's interests. And when the neighbor suffers want, we are to help, share, and lend to both friends and foes. Why not? Any closing thoughts on the seventh commandment? How do you think that would go over in the pulpit? All you have to do is change a few things and people would not know that you were, you know, a few of the particulars. You would not know that they were not talking to you. I don't know how well it would go.
As long as you weren't on a heavy building program.
As long as you weren't on a heavy building program. Tough one. The Reformation got started, you know, on a building program, gone astray. Did you know that? I didn't really realize that until I was asked to talk about Luther at one point. It was at Reformation time, you know, in October, the last Sunday in October. But then I couldn't come to the first Sunday of November. The people said, well, we're having something else there. Can you come the first Sunday of November? And I said, sure. Well, could you talk about Luther and stewardship, since this was the beginning of their stewardship project? Sure, why not? I can do anything, I suppose. And so I thought about Luther and stewardship, did some research on Luther and stewardship and things like that. And all of a sudden, it just kind of dawned on me that that the Reformation got started over a stewardship drive. It was called indulgences, the selling of indulgences to build St. Peter's Cathedral in Rome. What kind of is this? Right, it was. They're called the 95 Theses. We're about the stewardship drive called selling indulgences. It's like, I always have this dilemma. I'm involved in all kinds of children's sports programs in our neighborhood park, and trying to get kind of revitalizing our neighborhood back again and making it a safe place for children and adults. And the park programs, the things are all funded by pull tabs, of course, which is gambling. And I'm not great on gambling, so get into these dilemmas. Oh, let's do a paragraph or two on the Eighth Commandment. We got 5 minutes. Huh? The Eighth Commandment. Luther, you know, starts with our person, our body, with the Fifth Commandment. Actually, with the Fourth Commandment, he starts, honor your father and your mother, that which comes before you, what I would call our heritages. So first of all, God protects our heritage, that which comes before me. Then God protects my body, my personhood, my person, the integrity, and puts a boundary around it called thou shalt not kill it. Then God protects the closest bonds in my life, or my closest relationships, by saying, you're not allowed to cross over into someone else's spouse with adultery. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Then you have thou shalt not steal, even your property. And so the boundaries are there on property. And now comes the Eighth Commandment, thou shalt not bear false witness against your neighbor. And so we're going to see how this casts the net even wider in protecting the most vulnerable in society, and all of us in our vulnerabilities. Because aren't we vulnerable? Well, that's what we're going to find out. The Eighth Commandment. Somebody want to read the first paragraph?
Besides our own body, our right to husband, and our temporal property, we have one more treasure which is indispensable to us, namely our honor and good name, for it is intolerable to live among people in public disgrace and contempt. Therefore, God will not have our neighbor deprived of one's reputation, honor, and character any more than of one's money and possessions. A person would have every person maintain one's self-respect before one's wife, children, servants, and neighbors. In its first and simplest meaning, as the word stands, you shall not bear false witness. This commandment pertains to public courts of justice, where a poor innocent person is accused and maligned by false witnesses and consequently punished in body, property, or honor.
We will all be happy to know that there is a new translation of the Book of Concord coming out in the next few years. Well, what's going on in this first paragraph? Basically, he reviews, you know, how Luther reviews how it moves from body to bonds to property to now our name and honor, huh? Anything else going on? Technically, he says, of course, but this technically, you know, quite literally, this has to do with the law court, your turf, huh? District Attorney's Office. Bear false witness in a court against your neighbor. But again, he's going to say the commandment might have technically to do with bearing false witness in court, but the court represents kind of the place of last appeal of all of our public life. So that what this is talking about is the public nature of us all as human beings. to move beyond our properties and our intimate relationships now into a public world. So the eighth commandment is moving out into the public world, which in our kind of society has expanded tremendously from Luther's, interestingly enough. Much of our life, we live in a public setting nowadays, and so much of our life is governed in one way or another by public laws. So even our work life. In Luther's day, most people worked in their own fields and in their own, even guild people worked in their own back rooms and things like that. But most of us work in a public space that is regulated by public law. And so the publicness of life is tremendously expanded. And so maybe also beyond, in Luther's day, I'm sure beyond his possible imagination. And so this eighth commandment maybe even has a broader net to cast than even Luther thought it did.
He still brings up the poor and innocent.
Yes, right, again. He recognizes, as the biblical tradition does in generally, that God is particularly interested in the most vulnerable. And I think also in all of us and our vulnerabilities. Because the commandments do not say only, do not kill the poor. So God, and that's what morality is all about. Ethics and morality are about the most vulnerable in all of us and our vulnerabilities. Aren't they? So we want to do the next one. The first application of this commandment. Well, maybe I'll read it and then we'll do the third one. The first application of this commandment, then, is that everyone should help one's neighbor maintain one's rights. You must not allow these rights to be thwarted or distorted, but should promote and resolutely guard them. Whether the other be judge or witness, let the consequences be what they may. Here we have a goal set for our jurists: perfect justice and equity in every case. They should let right remain right, not perverting or concealing or suppressing anything on account of anyone's money, property, honor, or power. This is one aspect of the commandment in its plainest meaning, applying to all that takes place in the courtroom. He has a second one that has to do with we shouldn't slander pastors. That's the second one. So you see there's a couple paragraphs. There's a paragraph missing there. I just skipped that one. The third aspect of this commandment concerns us all. It forbids all sins of the tongue by which we may injure or offend our neighbor. False witness is clearly a work of the tongue. Whatever is done with the tongue against the neighbor, then, is forbidden by God. This applies to false preachers with their corrupt teaching and blasphemy, to false judges and witnesses with their corrupt behavior in court, and their lying and malicious talk outside of court. It applies particularly to the detestable, shameful vice of backbiting or slander by which the devil rides us. Of this much could be said. It is a common vice of human nature that everyone would rather hear evil than good about one's neighbor.
Wow.
That is kind of a common vice, isn't it? Even though we cannot tolerate having evil spoken of us. We want the golden compliments of the whole world, yet we cannot bear to hear the best spoken of others. To avoid this vice, therefore, we should note that nobody has the right to judge. This is kind of an interesting one. We should think about this next paragraph. To avoid this vice, therefore, we should note that no one has the right to judge and reprove one's neighbor publicly, even when you have seen a sin committed, unless the neighbor has been authorized to judge and reprove, unless you have been authorized to judge and reprove. There is a great difference between judging sin and having knowledge of sin. Knowledge of sin does not entail the right to judge it. I may see and hear that my neighbor sins, but to make that one the talk of the town is not my business. If I interfere and pass sentence on him, I fall into a greater sin than that one's. When you become aware of a sin, simply make your ears a tomb and bury it until you are appointed a judge and authorized to administer punishment by virtue of your office. I don't have time to spend some time about what Luther, the distinction Luther is making here about having an office. But being in an office for Luther is very important, and not only police officers and judges and jurists are in offices, but once you have children, you are then in the office of parent. And once you get married, you are in the office of spouse. And he actually talks about the office of neighbor at some points. So, he's saying, if you're not in the office of a judge, then you shouldn't go about the issue of judging others publicly. Those who are called backbiters, who are not content just to know but rush ahead and judge, learning a bit of gossip about someone else, they spread it into every corner, relishing and delighting in it like pigs that roll in the mud, and root around in it with their snouts. This, people were more earthy in Luther's day. We went through the Victorian age. This is nothing else than usurping the judgment and office of God, pronouncing the severest kind of verdict and sentence, or the harshest verdict a judge can pronounce is to declare someone a thief, murderer, traitor, etc.